Are humans more like chimps or bonobos?
The comparison that you always hear between humans and apes is with the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee, male-dominated, male violence, territorial. And that's the comparison that the anthropologists generally like. They don't like the bonobo because the bonobo is peaceful and sexy and female-dominated.
That's Frans de Waal. We talk with him about his new book, Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Then we re-air our 2019 conversation with Richard Love about his book, Our Wild Calling. It's about redefining the future of human-animal coexistence. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Chimpanzees and bonobos are our closest living relatives. We share nearly 99% of our DNA with both of these primate species. Yet the two couldn't be more different. You could almost say that chimps are from Mars and bonobos are from Venus. In his new book, world-famous primatologist Frans de Waal draws on decades of research into both human and animal behavior to parse the difference between biological sex and gender in determining behavior. De Waal shows that sex differences are no excuse for justifying gender inequality, and he challenges widely held beliefs about masculinity and femininity and common assumptions about authority, leadership, cooperation, and competition. Frans de Waal is Professor Emeritus of Primate Behavior at Emory University and the former director of the Living Link Center at the YERCS National Primate Research Center. He's the author of three previous books, including Mama's Last Hug. Frans de Waal, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Different, the book rests on comparisons between chimps, bonobos, and humans, and sometimes other animals as well, what we share with them and how we differ. But it's also about what males and females share and how they differ from each other. So first of all, just tell us about your approach to difference.
Well, the term different relates to the sex differences or gender differences that we see, and that males and females are really different in their behavior. It is not a statement like everything is different. You know, it's not like a statement like men are from Mars and women are from Venus, which I think is a total exaggeration. So I'm not exaggerating the differences, but I'm pointing out a few that exist.
You know, I love the way you start the book with Mama. You wrote a book about Mama. Tell us about her, and tell us about her as the example of the kind of leadership that females practice in the primate world.
Yeah, I think it's often overlooked by people that there are female leaders. So the image that people have of primates is a male boss who orders everyone around, including the younger males and including all the females. And that's all there is to it. And I think it's much more complex than that. And Mama was the alpha female of a very large, the world's largest chimpanzee colony in captivity. And she was alpha female for 40 years. So she saw a lot of alpha males come and go. And these alpha males actually depended on her because I think it was impossible for a male to reach the top without her support. So she was extremely influential. And so that's in a society like the chimpanzee where the males dominate physically. Still, you can have an alpha female with enormous leadership capacities, as Mama had. And she sort of was the one who kept the whole group together. And female leadership is found everywhere, not just in the chimpanzee. And I describe also bonobos, where female leadership, the alpha female is actually alpha over everyone, including the males.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more about Mama. And I mean, you have enormous respect for her. And tell us about her, not just as an example, but as an individual in her own right.
Well, she She reached the top in that colony very early in her life, and before she even had children. And I knew her at that time. So I left the Netherlands when I was a student. And she was already alpha female then. And I've seen her being alpha female all that time since. And she was the one who sort of kept the group together, in the sense that if there was a major commotion in the group, and sometimes there were major fights, especially involving males, Mama would be the one who afterwards would fix all the relationships. She would literally bring males together afterwards. She would approach one of them if they were not reconciling by themselves. She would approach one of them and even pull at his arm to get him to move towards the other. She would literally bring them together. And then she would wait till they groomed each other, and then she would leave. And so she fixed problems in the society. She was clearly the most respected female. So if there was any trouble among the females, they would all look at her, see what she would do at that point. And the males, even these big dominant males, physically dominant, they would seek her out and groom her and be very nice with her kids, because they needed her support for their political machinations. So yes, he was a very central figure, and not mean at all. You know, sometimes high-ranking individuals can be bullies, both males and females. That's a possibility. But she was not like that at all.
And talk a little bit about the difference between dominance and power. You know, I remember during the second wave feminist movement that began in the 1970s, that we talked about the difference between power over and power to, or empowerment. So can you apply that to the case of Mama and to her kind of leadership in general?
Yeah, I think we need to make a distinction. So, for example, in chimpanzee society, you may have a young alpha male who got to his position with the support of some older male. That's very typical, actually. The older males, they cannot reach the top anymore, but they play a lot of political games. And so then you have a young male who is basically in the pocket of an old male, who cannot do anything without the approval of the older male, cannot also not exclude the older male from, for example, mating with females or from food, because the old male is his supporter. So then you have an old male who has actually more power than the alpha male. And the same situation arises between males and females. You may have females who have more power than the high-ranking male. So I described, for example, in the book, a situation in the macaque troop where we had an old alpha male who certainly could not have kept his position if the alpha female had not decided that he needed to stay in power. So each time he was challenged by a younger male, the alpha female would walk up to him and stand right next to him, and the young male would back down because there was no way he was going to go against the alpha female, which in a macaque troop is the central figure of everything. So I think it's very important to point out that female leadership exists, that females have hierarchies. You know, there's often the misconception that hierarchies are for males and not for females. But, you know, the word pecking order comes from hens, doesn't come from roosters. Hierarchies are found everywhere in the animal kingdom, and the females have plenty of them. And so we need to realize that we have a sort of simplified image of the primate world, and sometimes simplified of the human world, because we live by wishful thinking very often in the human world. And then you hear people say, well, men are hierarchical and women are not, and women are not competitive with each other. Well, I think that's all nonsense. I think women are plenty competitive with each other.
You call yourself a feminist, but you make a distinction between sex and gender, Frans de Waal, in this book, Different. Tell us about that difference, and also explain to us where your feminist perspective has influenced the way you see this.
Well, the term gender comes from John Money, a sexologist, who was the first one to found a gender clinic in 1965. And he had noticed that sometimes people are born with one sex, but they don't identify as that sex, which we now call transgender people. And so he had discovered that that's the case, and he was very upset by the negative terminology. These people were called abnormal or weird or queer, or that we had all sorts of negative labels for these people. And he didn't agree with that, and he said, I'm going to introduce a new term, and this was the term gender, which relates more to the cultural side of sex differences and how you identify and how you behave and how you express yourself. And I am in full agreement with him on the term gender, that it is a useful term, because we cannot act as if the differences between men and women are purely biological, that there's only biology. Because we can see, if you travel from nation to nation, you can see how gender differences are expressed quite differently in different cultures. And so I fully agree that the term gender is useful to draw attention to the cultural side of things and the learning side. And my own position, when you say I'm a feminist, what I mean is that I'm all for gender equality. I'm not for glossing over the differences that exist, especially the biological differences. I think we need to take them very seriously, but I don't think that's a good reason to have inequality. And when people speak of gender inequality, we have to realize the problem is not with gender. The problem is with the inequality and the injustice and the backward thinking that still exists in some corners. That's where the problem is. And so my book is written partly to clear up what we know about sex and gender differences and how that relates to other primates, but also to make the argument that none of that is a reason for inequality. I don't see how that works. And of course, traditionally, we have always justified in our societies inequality by saying that men are smarter than women, men have more intellect. That's what the philosophers always have declared, is the male is the smarter of the two. And, you know, I've worked all my life on animal intelligence, and I've never noticed sex differences. And actually, our field doesn't talk much about sex differences because they're basically non-existent. And I would say nowadays in human society, now that our education for boys and girls is identical, all of that has evaporated. The so-called intellectual differences, I think, are non-existent.
So the intellectual differences are non-existent, but you do address in this book different differences that you say are innate. Maybe the intellectual, there's no intellectual difference, but brains are different between males and female. You point to, for example, the choice of preferences around toys, not just in humans, but also in primates, that fall into kind of the conventional view, you know, that females are more interested in nurture, males are more interested in competition. So could you address how that works without falling into the trap of equating difference with inequality?
Yeah, I think those differences in, for example, play behavior of the young, they have very little to do with intellect, I think, and very. I'm not sure what the role of the brain is in that, but we do know that if you give dolls, for example, to primates, like a teddy bear or something, the females will pick it up and very eager to pick it up and will hold it and hold it on their, put it on their back, on their belly, hold it against the nipple. The females will take care of the doll and sometimes for weeks on end. If you give it to a male, if he's interested at all, most of them are not, he will probably take it apart or fight with his friends over the doll or something like that. The males are not caretakers in that regard. And young females are also very interested in infants. So as soon as there's a newborn baby, the mother is surrounded by young females who want to get their hands on the baby. The young males are not interested in that. And what the young males do most is roughhousing, is rough and, what we call rough and tumble play. And that's universally also in the human species. Universally, boys do more of that than girls. And in the primates, all the primates, the young males do more of that than the young females. And so, yes, in the play behavior, we see already major differences in all the primates and in human society. And those differences probably relate to adult behavior because When females are adult, they will have infants and they will have to take care of them. And that's a very complex task. We often speak of the mother instinct, but, you know, mothering is really a complex business. And if females have had no experience at all with babies, and that happens sometimes at zoos, that you have, let's say, a group of gorillas where the females have never had a baby, then everything goes wrong. We know that, is that you have to somehow instruct them. It's interesting how zoos do that. Zoos will bring in a mother with a young baby and have her nurse in front of the gorillas. And she will do that every day. And the gorillas will learn from that. So instruction is absolutely essential for maternal behavior. And that's why at a young age, the young females need to learn a little bit about that.
And they bring in human mothers.
They bring in human mothers because, of course, anatomically, humans and apes are very similar. People don't always recognize that, but we are extremely similar. And that's why gorillas, by watching a human mother do her thing with the baby, they learn something from that, and they can apply that to their own body as well.
You say that these kinds of innate differences, sex differences between males and females, and the behavior is due to evolution. So explain, you know, what is the survival or the fitness preference for, I mean, this may be obvious, but it wasn't actually obvious to me when I read your book, Franz de Waal, when I read Different. It was a new thing to me that this difference is really rooted in evolution. So explain that.
Well, the difference we just discussed, you know, the play behavior and so on, and the interest of young females in infants and in dolls, that is easy to explain because, as I said, these females, they will later become mothers and they need to learn a lot of things. And so evolution has made them interested in that issue because they need to learn so much about it. And the competitiveness of young males and the roughhousing has a sort of two functions in evolutionary sense. One is it prepares them for a life in which there's going to be quite a bit of competition and rivalry with other males. And so they need to learn how to fight. And they do that by having mock fights that they do mostly for fun. But they also need to learn to control their strengths because they are so much stronger than often than females and certainly much stronger than the young. So an adult male gorilla, with his fist, if he puts a little bit pressure on a baby, he's going to kill the baby. And so and adult male gorillas do play with baby gorillas. And so they have learned all these inhibitions, enormous inhibitions that they need. And they learn them during play behavior as young males. And so there's a functional side to these differences. And there's other differences, of course, between the sexes that probably also have a functional side and are due to evolution.
Now, chimpanzees are much more of a male-dominated society, mama notwithstanding, than our other closest primate relatives, the bonobos. Talk about the differences between these two primates. And you also say in the book that it's possible that we are actually more closely related to bonobos, or they maybe are more recent primate relative than even chimpanzees.
Chimpanzees and bonobos are actually genetically equally close or equally distant from us. There's no difference in that regard. The bonobo is a totally different character than the chimpanzee. And the comparison that you always hear between humans and apes is with the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee, male-dominated, male violence, territorial. And that's the comparison that the anthropologists generally like. They don't like the bonobo because the bonobo is peaceful and sexy and female-dominated. And the anthropologists, for some reason, they have invested very heavily in a human evolutionary scenario with violence and warfare. And they're not ready to adopt the bonobo. And I'm arguing in the book, especially from a gender perspective, I think the bonobo is awfully interesting. And the bonobo is exactly equally close to us. There's really no good reason to exclude the bonobo from the story that we tell. And so in the bonobo, the females are not larger than males. The females are smaller than males. but they collectively dominate them. And they can do that because they live in an environment in which they can travel together more than the chimpanzee, who needs to spread out over the forest to find enough food. The bonobos can travel together and hang together, and that's what the females do. They develop some sort of sisterhood, and they collectively dominate the males, and they have an alpha female who usually relies on a small clique of top females, like four or five top females, and they together run the whole show and are in charge. And it's so interesting to compare these two. Also, the peacefulness of the bonobo is, of course, very interesting when people say, we have always waged war, we will always wage war because we are a violent species. And I think, well, we have a very close relative who is more like a hippie than like a warrior. And so it's interesting to think about that.
Right. They're the make love, not war primates. And tell us more about this make love, not war. How do the bonobos approach sex, you know, and also who they have sex with?
Yeah, bonobos have, I consider them bisexual in the sense that I don't see much of a preference in them for males or females to have sex with. They have sex with everybody. And the females have a large clitoris. It's interesting that the clitoris has been downplayed by since Freud in human psychology and human biology. But some species, like the dolphin and the bonobo and the human, they have a large clitoris, which must relate to female pleasure. There's no other function for the clitoris. And we now know from anatomical studies that the clitoris has as many nerve endings as the penis. And so it is certainly an organ of pleasure. And the bonobo has a very prominent one. And bonobo females engage in a lot of female-female sex. And that has probably to do with the bonding that is necessary for that kind of society, since they have this sisterhood of solidarity between females who together dominate the males and keep the males from being too aggressive with them, or killing infants, as happens in some species. The females need to bond and need to resolve issues between themselves. And the way they do that is with these brief sexual contacts. I add the word brief because people always think that they must be having sex the whole day. That's really not the case. They have these brief sexual encounters. They last 10 seconds, maybe 20 seconds maximum. So these are brief genital encounters that they have. And they have them regardless of males and females. And the combination of partners is very variable.
You know, it's so interesting. They have very prominent genitalia, the females, but also the males. And so prominent with the females that it actually can be kind of uncomfortable for them to sit. So what is the evolutionary advantage of or purpose of that kind of prominence?
Well, it is intended clearly to attract males. So it's what we call in biology, we call it this sexually selected. It's selected because the males are attracted. And so females who have these genital swellings, they are more successful in attracting males. And actually, when the females don't have these swellings, which is in between their cycles, you know, or when they're pregnant, when they don't have these swellings, then the males are not really interested in them for sexual reasons. And so it's an uncomfortable structure. And we humans can be very happy, I think, that we don't have that structure. But I must also add, you know, that they don't always have these swellings because females get pregnant and then they have a long nursing period. They nurse their offspring for 4 to 5 years. They have a very slow development. And so during all that time, the female is not ovulating. So the interbirth interval in apes like chimps and bonobos is 5 to 6 years. So there's a long period of time where they don't have these genital swellings. And then all of a sudden they start cycling again. And then they come up again and they are there to attract the males. So it's not like they have them all the time.
And bonobo males also have sex with each other. Is that right?
Yeah, but much less so. And you would expect that because they are not as bonded as the females are. So males have sometimes sex with each other. In other species, that's actually more common. So homosexual activity in the primates is not unusual at all. The only thing that's maybe unusual is exclusive homosexual orientation. But, you know, in human society, the exclusiveness of sexual orientations is also in question. So, for example, a recent study suggested that men who are heterosexual, you should call them mostly heterosexual, because almost all men have some homosexual tendencies. So we suppress that in our culture. Of course, we want people to choose. You're either going to be gay or you're going to be heterosexual. We like to put people in pigeonholes and say what they are. But in reality, and that's what Alfred Kinsey already said long ago, in reality, it's more like a spectrum of sexual preferences.
So talking about males, you have a chapter on violence and rape. You point out that male primates, including humans, are the overwhelming source of violence, but that there are also differences between humans and other primates when it comes to violence and rape. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think rape is extremely rare, even in the chimpanzee, where the males dominate physically. Rape, what we call usually forced copulation, so copulating by a male with a female against her will, so that she's struggling to get free or something like that, that is extremely rare behavior. And I think rape is more common in human society than in other primates. And that is partly, that's my guess, I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist, but my guess is that in humans we have these nuclear families that live separate, in separate homes, where you have a male and a female, sometimes more, but at any rate, the male is in a situation where he can control the female without an enormous amount of resistance from the group. That's an impossibility in a primate society where everything is out in the open. If a male tries to force himself on a female, the females will usually collectively object to that. And so we have created this artificial situation of individuals who are more or less isolated, at least for some periods of time. And we've seen, for example, during the COVID crisis, that domestic violence went up, because people were cooped up at home. So I think we have created a situation where we actually have more rape than you will ever find in a primate society.
And that has implications for human evolution as well, because, you know, after all, for most of our history, we were living in bands of 50 or fewer individuals. You know, it's interesting to speculate whether rape is more a product of civilization as opposed to, or so-called civilization, as opposed to natural to humans?
Well, the small groups is an interesting point, because in small groups, of course, everyone has a reputation. And I think a rapist in a small society may get into deep trouble. So one anthropologist, Kim Hill, has one time set up a mathematical model of how would a young man do in a hunter-gatherer society if he were a rapist, with all the pluses and all the minuses. And he concluded that the family of the woman would probably take revenge on a guy like that. And they might exclude him, or he might lose friends, or he might need to move to another place if he can, if he's accepted in another place. Or the woman may not adopt the kid, may not take care of it, the product of rape. And so he concluded that, because people have argued that rape is possibly an adaptive strategy, is possibly evolved to produce more offspring. People have speculated about that. And it's unlikely. I think in a small-scale society, I think it's unlikely that a young man can get away with it easily. So that's also the argument I use in my book. I'm not a big fan of that kind of theories. I think rape is a bit of an artificial product of the way we have set up our societies nowadays.
And in fact, you say that there has been a shift. I mean, you spend a lot of time in this book, Different, examining how the scientific establishment has approached gender from we could say, a fairly biased point of view. But you say recently there's been a shift to a more optimistic view of human nature, not the kind of male-dominated one that we are inevitably a war-making species and, you know, survival of the fittest, etc. Could you talk about that more optimistic view and what we can take away from our fellow primates?
Yeah, the view in the 70s and the 80s was very much like the selfish gene view, like, we are selfish, competitive, violent. There's actually nothing good about the human species. That was sort of the view, which maybe after World War II was a realistic view based on how we had behaved as a species. But nowadays, there's a lot of attention in the literature, both by anthropologists and economists and psychologists, on the cooperative side of the human species. Humans are really special in how cooperative we are and how we do things together. And so that whole view of humans and by extension other species as entirely selfish and competitive is sort of falling apart. And, you know, it's also reflected in, you know, in biology we talk about the struggle for life and we usually mean by that competition. But, you know, there's an enormous amount of animals. Think of the ants, think of elephants. There's an enormous amount of animals who survive by cooperating with each other, doing things together, or helping each other against their enemies, or hunting together, but wolves and dolphins and so on do. So I think there's much more emphasis on cooperation nowadays and less on violent competition. And I think that was absolutely necessary because I felt that during the period of the 70s and the 80s, the way people talked about animals and humans was extremely biased towards these negative depictions of human nature.
And, of course, the lessons that we can learn from our closest relatives, the bonobos and the chimpanzees. It's a fascinating exploration in your book, Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Franz de Waal, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
You're welcome.
Franz de Waal, go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Different. Next up, the powerful connections between humans and the other animals. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2019, we spoke with Richard Louvre about his book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Let's listen back to that now. Richard Louvre's landmark book, Last Child in the Woods, inspired an international movement to connect children and nature. Now, Louvre redefines the future of human-animal coexistence. Our Wild Calling explores the powerful and mysterious bonds between humans and animals and how they can transform our mental, physical, and spiritual lives. They also can serve as an antidote to the growing epidemic of human loneliness and help us tap into the empathy required to preserve life on Earth. Richard Louvre is a journalist and author of 10 books. They include, in addition to Our Wild Calling and Last Child in the Woods, The Nature Principle and Vitamin N, The Essential Guide to Nature. He's co-founder of the Children and Nature Network. Well, Richard Louvre, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is such a beautiful book, Our Wild Calling. You start the book with an encounter with a black fox. Tell us about that encounter.
Well, I was on Kodiak Island with my son, and he was working as a guide in the lodge there. And I was on my way to the lodge, and I had my head down looking at my wallet because he was my guide, so I needed to tip him. And you're not supposed to look at your wallet when you're walking around Kodiak Island because there's so many Alaskan brown bears, which are huge grizzlies, and they walk right through camp. And so I wasn't paying attention. And suddenly I was confronted by these amazingly, startlingly bright eyes, piercing eyes. And fortunately, it wasn't a bear. It was a fox. And the foxes on Kodiak Island are among the largest in the world. And this fox blocked my path, and he wouldn't get out of my way. And he just stared at me. And I was really struck by his eyes. I was struck by what I saw or didn't see, or what the mystery was there, what I felt when I looked into those eyes. And I thought, is he rabid? He's not getting out of my way. He's not afraid of me. He's standing 3 feet in front of me. So finally, I just moved a little bit forward, and he moved to the side. And I said, you want to go with me to the lodge? I'm going up to the lodge. And he trotted along next to me until he moved off into the weeds and disappeared. I asked the lodge. They were not feeding that fox. There was something else going on there. I don't think he was sick. I don't think he was rabid. I think, you know, in the introduction of the book where I described that, I think he was telling me to pay attention. And that encounter made me very curious about what was happening during those moments. And I didn't have an answer then. So the focus of the book, the search of the book, is really what happens between us and another animal. And I mean literally between us, if it's a wild animal or if it's a pet. And so the book is a lot of stories that have been sent to me, or I've collected, or I've interviewed people about that moment or about their relationships with other animals. And these are often very profound stories that people tell, and they get more meaningful as people tell them.
More meaningful as people tell them? Why is that?
I think that this is deep within us. This is deep within our species. You know, tens of thousands of years ago, when we were early on this planet, we would go out and do our work during the day and hunt and survive. And then we'd come back to the fire at night, and we would tell stories. We'd tell animal stories. Sometimes we would act out those stories. We would dance. We would become the bear or the fox. And this is deep within us. We have a need to tell these stories. And those stories for our ancestors had deep meaning that grew into myth. And our encounters with animals have deeper meaning as we retell them. They become, in a sense, personal myths. So the nature of that meaning is also what the book is about.
Yeah, it's interesting. You write about this, and I was struck about how humans often regard animal encounters as omens, which is really ascribing meaning to those encounters. And that really hit me, because back in June of 2012, I was out on my bike prior to going to visit my mother, who was in the hospital, and we all knew she was in hospice, basically in the hospital, palliative care. And I saw a cormorant catching an eel. And then 5 minutes later, I was hit by a truck.
Oh, my gosh.
And I ended up in a hospital room one floor above my mother, who was dying. And I've always felt, and I cannot explain this, but I've always felt that there was an association between the two events, that one was an omen of the other. It was a very striking thing. And I'm just going to ask you, what do you make of that story?
Now, when you saw that cormorant, was that the reason you had the accident? Because you were distracted, or did I miss something?
No, I wasn't, but I felt that it was filled, that it was an omen. I just felt so strongly when I saw that creature that it was an omen of something. And then I was hit, and I was, you know, I mean, I was in a cast for 4 months, but there was no lasting damage. But it was all connected with the sense that this was an omen of some, that like what you just said, I had to pay attention. And believe me, when I was in the hospital, you know, one floor above my mother, I mean, I got to spend a lot more time with her than I would have if I hadn't been in the hospital.
Well, in the studies of, you know, the meaning that we either ascribe or come to us through animals. And by the way, I'm not sure I care whether we have projected that meaning into the experience, or the experience actually has that meaning and the animal is trying to communicate to us in some way. I'm not sure that that matters, because we still find meaning. In the studies of this kind of thing, birds are often the messengers of death, particularly owls. But I, you know, that is quite a striking image of the cormorant and the eel. So I'm not sure what to make of that. I'm sure you know better what to make of that. Did you tell your mother that story?
No, I didn't, but I did tell my other family.
What did they think of it?
It made total sense to them without them even knowing why either.
Well, this is part of what comes through. I mean, in the stories that are told to me in the book from all kinds of different people, including hardcore, stern, very stern scientists who also have these experiences, like the oceanographer who had a transcendent experience with an octopus, a 12-foot span octopus. These stories are all around us. And I think that this language is all around us, that we have a ring of communication around us all the time. And it's in what I call the oldest language, which precedes verbal language. And it is not only around us, it is between us and another animal. Now, many of us experienced that when we were kids with our dog, for instance, or a cat, a pet. We knew about that when we were kids. And as we grow up, we tend to lose that or be talked out of it. But one of the experiences I described in the book is my own experience being on a lake in a boat. It was early morning. I have a little electric motor, so it's very quiet. And I saw on the shore what I thought were two vultures. And I eased up very carefully. And they were not vultures. They were two giant golden eagles. And they were eating a dead carp on the shore. And for what seemed like forever, they looked at me and I looked at them. They would go down and get a bite of the fish, their eyes never leaving mine. Then they would go back up and keep looking at me. When I say this seemed to go on forever, many of the stories that I collected from people talked about different kinds of altered states that people feel when they have these experiences, one of which is that time either bends or disappears. One person called it this sense of being in whole time. So this went on for quite a while, and then I finally had to go. I felt something change between the eagles and me. And I'm not speaking for the eagles. They may have just been trying to decide if I was edible. But I went home and I talked to my younger son who was home from college. And I told him about that. And I said, Matthew, whoever I say I am, I'm not. Whoever I was in those moments is who I actually am. And I don't have the words to explain this. This is beyond human language, beyond verbal. And much of the... Some of the research has actually suggested that there is a kind of universal language, a super language, or the oldest language, as I call it, that many species share, and we can be sensitized to if we work at it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Richard Louv about his latest book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. And about this oldest language, you even talk about, well, one thing you say is that we have more senses than we think and that we can use them in human-animal communication. Say more about that.
Well, the people who study the human senses no longer talk about only five senses. They talk conservatively about 9 or 10. Some scientists talk about as many as 30 human senses and some even more than that. And they all have names. We have some of the ability of bats to use echolocation to make our way around in a dark room. Some people who have lost their sight are learning how to do that. We have some bloodhound in us, in a sense. We can follow a trail, a scent trail through the forest on our hands and knees with our eyes covered and our ears plugged. And the people doing that study said that the college students, who are the guinea pigs in this case, who followed that scent trail, did something unexpected that all animals who make their living with their noses do. The students zigzagged as they followed that trail. So this is part of us. This is deep within us, these different senses. But what we do, and I write about this quite a bit in my other books about, including Last Child in the Woods, which was about what I call nature deficit disorder. What we do is we sit in front of screens all day, and I do this, and we set up learning environments for our kids at school where we've canceled recess often, where we have them in front of screens all the time. And much of that time, we're spending and they're spending a lot of energy trying to push out and block as many of those many, many senses as we can so that we can concentrate on that screen. And through a couple senses, allegedly go anywhere in the universe through the internet. I think that's the very definition of being less alive. I don't know any parents who want their kids to be less alive. So we have these senses, but we don't use them very much. So much of this book is about how animals bring us alive, other animals. We're animals too, that those animals bring us alive to those senses if we pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And something very interesting is that there are even some people who are working on technology that would enable us to eventually talk with other animals. I'd like you to, you know, say what that is and also how revolutionary that would be.
There's one scientist whose name I can't pronounce, but he talks about his study of prairie dogs and their language. And it turns out that prairie dogs are good journalists and they don't deal in fake news. The prairie dogs at the edge of a prairie dog colony can see somebody or something coming, and they can describe it in some detail. They can say whether it has a white hat on, what kind of animal it is, what its intentions seem to be. And with its language, it can pass that on to the next prairie dog and then the next and the next. And pretty soon the whole colony knows about what this thing is that's approaching them in some detail. The scientist has been using digital technology to record and then using computers to decode that language. And it's probably the most sophisticated animal language that's yet been decoded. And he says that they string together clusters of sounds into something like sentences. And that through artificial intelligence and the use of computers and digital technology, he may be able, or they may be able soon, to be able to feed prairie dog language into a computer and then decode it and have us hear the prairie dogs speaking in whatever our language is, in English, for example. And the reverse could be true. We could talk to the prairie dogs in prairie dog language. Now, some of this experimentation is a little strange. There's some people working on special dog leashes that would be attached to a vest on a dog that could actually tell us more about what the dog is smelling, what the dog is thinking about. I think that that is a little overdoing it. We've had 30,000 years at least of co-evolution with dogs. We pretty much know what they're thinking, and they pretty much know what we're thinking by now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was some recent research that showed that it actually was their ability to make a connection to us. I don't know. You may know this research better. It happened about, I read about it about a week ago, that what makes that for that special relationship is the dog's ability to create an empathic bond with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And there has been research recently. In fact, there's another new book out that it's coming out. I think it's called Dog is Love. And it's fascinating because it shows how dogs really do feel love for us, but they feel love for anything that they had an early attachment to. If they grow up with sheep, they have a sense of love for sheep. So we have this empathy with dogs. They have it with us. And this comes in part through centuries of coevolution, thousands of years. But it also comes individually. I talk about my dog in the book, whose name was Banner. And he and I had an very intense bond. He was a collie. We spent most of our life, most of our my boyhood years and its boyhood, its puppy years in the woods. You know, my parents didn't know where we were, but my dog did. And that empathy that I felt for him and he felt for me was intense. And some of the studies really suggest that having animals in their lives really build empathy in children. And this is one of the important gifts that that other animals give us. One thing I wanted to say is a story I started to tell about the two eagles on the shore. I tried to figure out what was going on there. And again, I can't speak for the eagles. But what I felt, and what so many people who tell me the stories in these books, in this book, feel, is that there was something between us. And the great philosopher Martin Buber, I have to often be careful not to say Justin Bieber, Martin Buber, the philosopher, talked about in his essay, I Am Thou, a famous essay, when he was talking about the relationship between people, he said that you and I don't actually exist. What exists is between us, the relationship. And he meant that in a different way than many of us use that word, relationship. He thought of it as a kind of electricity that some people call God. That's what people described to me, and that's what I felt in those moments, is something between us. And sometimes it's with another person, and sometimes it's with another animal. And we're just not very sensitized to feeling that, certainly not with wild animals. But when we begin to notice it, it's all around us. And I think that this has something to do with our sense of loneliness in the world. And by the way, I tried to name that thing between us and another animal. It doesn't really have a name, so I called it the habitat of the heart. And I believe that there are two habitats. There's the physical habitat that we work very hard to protect for other animals and for ourselves. But then there's this habitat of the heart, and we don't do very much to try to protect or to nurture that. And the thing is that if one of those two habitats goes, so does the other. And I actually think that this is part of the future of environmentalism, to begin to pay as much attention to the habitat of the heart as we do to the physical.
You have a term called solifilia. What is that?
Solastalgia is a term created by a philosopher in Australia, Glenn Albrecht, to describe that intense, a kind of a homesickness we feel about the home that is being torn down around us. It's not for a home in the past long ago. It's for the home we're in right now. He also talks about solophilia, which is the love of life, like biophilia is the love of life. But he has another term, which is a replacement he feels that we ought to use for the term that's often used, which is that we are in the Anthropocene geological era. He doesn't like that because that is focused on human beings at the center by the definition of that term. So he talks about the
Ecozoic.
That's Thomas Berry who talks about that, which is a similar meaning, but the symbiocene is what Glenn talks about in terms of that's what we ought to be. We ought to be skipping the Anthropocene, which is human-centered, and going to the symbiocene, which is a concept of being in symbiosis with all of life, that we're all in this together, and we're not necessarily in charge. We have to have some partners in this.
Yes. You know, you say this on the day that I'm talking with you now is the same day that the UN just came out with another dire warning of where we are headed in terms of climate change. Everybody knows that we have to get off of the fossil fuel era, and yet emissions are still going up. So say more about the symbiocene, because it's not just a concept. You flesh it out in the book with some pretty interesting ideas about what it would mean to live our lives with the full recognition that we are in a symbiotic relationship with everything else around us.
E.O. Wilson, the great scientist at Harvard, who has talked about the biophilia hypothesis, he didn't make up the word biophilia, which is love of life, but he did popularize it, and particularly in this biophilia hypothesis, which holds that we are genetically wired as a species to have a need for other species, to have an affiliation with the rest of nature. And that when we don't get that, we don't do so well. He talks about the Anthropocene as actually the age of loneliness. Where that leads, if you follow our logic in terms of us being the center of all of it and responsible for all of it, and in fact, destroying a lot of it, is it will be down to a few domestic animals and us. And he describes that as the age of loneliness. There are other people who have talked about this in terms of species loneliness, that our human loneliness that we feel that is now seen as an epidemic by many medical people, including the World Health Organization, who say that human loneliness, social isolation, will soon outdistance obesity as a cause of early death, not only because of suicide, but because of all of the diseases that are attached to human loneliness that come along with that. I make the case in the book that this human loneliness and this epidemic of it is rooted in a deeper loneliness, this species loneliness. We are desperate not to be alone in the universe and not to feel that way. The parks, the urban parks that have the highest benefit for human psychological health happen to be the parks with the highest biodiversity. Again, I don't think that's an accident. We need to feel connected in the universe and not alone. I mean, why else would we look for Bigfoot? Because we have this desperate need. Why else would we look for intelligent life on other planets? It's not just curiosity. It's we don't want to be alone in the universe. That may not be a good idea to find that intelligent life. Stephen Hawking has warned us, by the way. And in fact, the irony is that we're not alone. We don't have to look beyond where we are right now, that we are surrounded by intimacy. We are surrounded by this larger conversation between other animals and with other animals, and also plants, far more as now known about how trees communicate, not only with each other, but plants communicate with animals. So this is I call it the great whisper, which is all around us if we pay attention. Your question, though, is more about what would the symbiocene look like? I spend a section in the book talking about what our cities could be. I think our cities could be engines of biodiversity, not just the enemy of biodiversity. We could change them through what's called biophilic design, which creates different kinds of workplaces and schools and homes that are infused with natural elements around and in them. The workplaces that have been designed in this way, the studies show that people in them are far more productive. Sick time is reduced, turnover of employees is reduced. What if whole cities could be like that? And I think they can. If we look at our backyards, for instance, there's a great book, Bringing Nature Home, Doug Ptolemy has written, that I cite, that talks about creating a homegrown national park. And by that he means, what if our yards were turned into native species? You know, all through our cities, we would have wildlife corridors on private land created by all of us that would produce the insects that are fast being exterminated as well, that provide the basis for the food chain, for birds, for all of life eventually. We can do this where we live. We don't have to wait. And in doing that, it produces more a connection between us and the rest of life, which reduces our loneliness, which the studies have shown improve our physical health, our psychological health, our emotional health, and I would argue our spiritual health. In the prior books, I really focused on children and how it affects them. But I think that this focusing on animals, which I've done in this newest book, Our Wild Calling, is a place that most of us can understand more immediately than perhaps we can connecting with the plants in our yard. Sometimes other people have more of a sense of that connection to plants, but I think particularly for kids, animals are more immediate, particularly mammals.
And Richard Louv, in Our Wild Calling, you also talk about the kind of awareness. I mean, we've been talking about that all along here, but very specifically, I was struck by one of the things that you said, because I think it's a practice that we could actually use every day, which is to check to see if an animal pattern changes due to our presence. And that could be, as you say, whether through the intrusion of a single footstep or scaling it all the way up to the climate crisis, an awareness of every moment of interaction that we have with the world and the living beings around us.
There's a fellow named John Young that I profile in the book that I've known for many years. He takes hundreds of people into the forest to learn bird language, literally to learn bird language, not so much to talk to them, but to listen to them, to pay attention. And this language, this oldest language, which I mentioned earlier, is not only made up of sounds, it's made up of behaviors and patterns that seem to transcend species. Birds have calls that ground squirrels understand and will actually mimic to warn other ground squirrels, for instance, alarm sounds that birds make, if we pay attention. And he talks about ripples, which is the term he uses for the effect that we have as individuals when we enter any environment, whether it's a cocktail party or a forest, and that everyone around us feels our presence consciously or unconsciously when we enter their territory. And those ripples can be good or they can be bad. And we see a lot of the bad ones around us, but we can also have ones that are a lot more like kindness than the ones we usually send out. And animals really respond to that, by the way.
Yes. I just saw the movie about Mr. Rogers with Tom Hanks. And, you know, Fred Rogers was doing that in the human world in the way that you're really talking about in a larger world. And he also makes the point in the movie and elsewhere that it's all about relationship, that we are not things just colliding in the night, that we are all in relationship with each other.
And that is true. And most of the time when we talk about that, we talk about other human beings. And our wild calling really is about the same thing in a sense, but it's with the life around us, the other creatures that we share the earth with. And I have an experience that I had with Mr. Rogers. I went to interview him many, many years ago. I took my then 5-year-old Matthew with me. It's one of the only times I've seen Matthew speechless. And I had a question for Mr. Rogers. And we were sitting there and I said, you know, Matthew asked me this question the other day at 5 years old, and I don't have a good answer for it. And the question is, are God and Mother Nature married or just good friends? And like you, I laughed when Matthew asked me that question. Mr. Rogers did not. And, you know, after a while, he and Matthew ended up over in the corner having this long discussion about this question. And when they came back to me, Fred Rogers said to Matthew, "Matthew, as you grow older, would you let me know the answer that you come to on your own to that question?" I never heard the detail, really, of what they were talking about, what conclusion they'd come to. But years later, I see Matthew typing feverishly at my wife's computer in the next room. And he, at 16, I think, was sending a letter to Mr. Rogers. He printed out, he put it in the mail, he sent it. And a couple weeks later, we got a letter from Mr. Rogers saying, thanking Matthew for sharing what he had come to understand about whether God and Mother Nature are married or good friends. And he said, say hello to your dad, too. And we've got that letter framed on the wall. But I think that understanding that Fred Rogers had, as you point out, can really be applied to our relationship with all of life around us. And that this is essential, that we can't just deal with climate change and biodiversity collapse by talking about data. So much of biology and science has been reduced to data. When you talk to the most enlightened scientists, for example, Einstein, you know, he had a sign on his door. It says, not everything that counts in life can be counted. And this is essential, I think, to our connection with other life.
We're talking with Richard Louvre about his latest book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. You know, as I was reading your book, you know, there was this undercurrent of grief. You know, for example, you point out that in Bolivia, they put into the Constitution the law of the rights of Mother Earth, of Pachamama, yet that president who did that has been overthrown, and the person who has called herself a self-appointed president in his place said, we're going to replace Pachamama with Christianity, which seemed to be really missing the point. Everywhere we see, it's not a good picture we see. And yet this book is really profoundly hopeful. You talk about the kind of consciousness that you feel really is beginning to take hold. So I'm sure you have a certain element of that grief in you as well. I wonder if you could talk about that and the hope that you express in this wonderful book.
Well, thank you. I think 13 or 14 years ago was the publication of Last Child in the Woods. And that book, to my surprise, which talked about what I called nature deficit disorder, really took off. It became a phenomenon. It's hard to watch the growth of that phenomenon and not be hopeful. Mm-hmm. That led to the Children of Nature Network, which is a nonprofit that led or stimulated or helped grow, which was, I believe it was already growing or about to grow, a worldwide movement to connect kids to nature. That movement has made many improvements in life. There are now, the number of nature-based preschools has increased about 500%. We see recess, I think, for other reasons, but also for this disconnect from nature, beginning to come back in school districts. We see the growth of biophilic architecture. We see, the return of the idea that education has something to do with the experiences we have in the real world, that it's not just data. We have parents all over the country and now all over Canada and the world who are creating family nature clubs, which are groups of families that band together to defy their fear of strangers and have nature experiences together. The Family Nature Club in San Diego, where we recently moved from, now has between 2,000 and 3,000 families in it. Families, not individuals. We see a lot changing now on that issue. And I found that it doesn't matter what somebody's politics or religion is. They all want to tell me about the treehouse they had when they were kids. If they were old enough, if they are old enough today to have had that experience when they were kids. And nobody, no matter what their politics, wants this to be the last generation to have the chance to go out in the woods and lie in the grass and watch the leaves move. Nobody wants to be in that generation. So this is actually a unifying cause. You can't look, personally, I can't look at the growth of that movement without being hopeful. And I think that this book, which is about a relationship with other animals, in many ways is the next stage. Most of the research on the impact of the natural world on our children's and our health and cognition and ability to create, most of that research has been on green space. There's the assumption made that there are animals in that green space, but primarily it's about the impact of vegetation on us. That research has gone from about 60 studies that I could find when I wrote Last Child in the Woods to nearly 1,000 studies today, and they all tend to point in the same direction. But animals are missing from that research. Wild animals are. Domestic animals, because of the growth of animal-assisted therapy, with equine therapy, with horses, with dogs, with companion animals, all of that has grown on the domestic side. But we've seen very little research about the impact of wild animals on our lives, on our health. And that includes the coyote walking through our backyard in an urban place. Increasingly, wild animals are moving into cities. So we need to pay attention to that. We need to know what is coming into our cities and understand it. And then we have two choices. We can either exterminate the wildlife coming into our cities, which many people want to do, or we can understand it, protect us, protect it, and protect ourselves and other human beings from it when we need to. And I have an idea about how to do that, but my answer has been way too long. So.
Oh, well, I'm curious about that. And how would one do that?
Well, I mentioned the growth of the family nature clubs. What if we had something like that, something like Neighborhood Watch, which is set up in neighborhoods to watch for strangers and to watch for elements of crime? What if we had something like that called Neighborhood Wild Watch, which would be, you know, your kids, parents, the retirees at the end of the corner, who would create local clubs in their neighborhoods to watch the animals, to watch not only the domestic animals, but watch the wild animals that are coming into the neighborhoods at ever-increasing numbers, and to understand them. And they're fascinating. I mean, this would add, I think, interest and joy to people's lives, but also to do two things: to protect people from the ones that they need protecting from. For instance, the animals that are too aggressive, the animals that look sick, and to know what to do when they see that coyote that is too aggressive, but also to train the other neighbors, to teach them not to feed the animals. Not good for the animals, not good for us, the wild animals. And then also to protect those wild animals by understanding them more, by respecting them more, by recognizing the joy and the stories that they give us. If we did that in an organized way with these neighborhood animal watch groups all over our cities, all over our country and the world, I think we would experience something, I think, profoundly good for our species. That would be one way to deal with our species loneliness. That way, by the way, also increases social capital among people. It creates connections among people. And I would say, as an aside, John Young, that I mentioned earlier, who teaches bird language, mm-hmm. he talks about how people who learn this bird language about it by paying attention, they go home and they find their relationships with their spouses are better. And John has a short explanation. He says they find they're actually listening to their spouses.
That's wonderful. Well, great story. Among many great stories in this book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Richard Lube, it has been just a delight to talk with you about this book.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thanks for this program, too.
Richard Lube, talking with us in 2019. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.